my friends at Future Primitive. I'm actually having a conversation on Skype today with Evelyn Gerda Lindner. She is a transdisciplinary scholar in social sciences and humanities. She holds two doctorates, one in medicine and the other in psychology. Her research focuses on human dignity, and she believes that the humiliation of honor and dignity may be the strongest obstacle on the way to a decent world community. She is the founding president of Human Dignity and Humiliation Studies, a global transdisciplinary fellowship of concerned academics and practitioners who wish to promote dignity and transcend humiliation. So welcome back to Future Primitive, Evelyn. And I'd like to ask you to begin with telling us what you feel dignity is, what you feel and what you think it is.
It is lovely to be with you again, Joanna. It's now quite a number of years ago that we spoke for the first time, and it's such an honor and pleasure and privilege to be with you now again. And there are many years in between now that I have had the chance to think about dignity. What is dignity? You might have noticed that the Arab Spring is often called a dignity. The people in Egypt, in other Arab countries, when they began with their revolution, they said it's all about dignity. I have lived in Egypt for 7 years, from 1984 to 1991. And when I heard this, I knew that dignity is being understood in very, very many different ways in different parts of the world. It has become a word that somehow includes many, many different views. It starts with that you feel respected. And this is what my friends in Egypt meant when they said it's all about dignity. We want to be respected as people who have the right to live dignified lives. And this includes in Egypt particularly, since I'm not, for example, the chance to have a home, to have a family, to have economic circumstances that are somehow, decent. And as soon as you come into this stage of definition, I think everybody around the world I meet agrees to this kind of definition of dignity, to have the basics of life covered. You know, you have access to clean water, to not, you know, this would be the minimum, but to have not just clean water, but to have a decent life, to have what others in your society take for granted, to have a home and to have a family. For example, this is what is important in Egypt. So up to that point, everybody I know would agree. And you have very, very big problems in defining dignity further. And these problems are not just in the lives of people around the planet, but also in academia. What is dignity? It's a very, very loose and sometimes almost empty concept as soon as you try to define it further. So for me, I would say that dignity is, if I were to define it, is that we as a human family on this planet arrange our affairs, our life on this planet in ways that we as members of this human family can live together in ways that are both, you know, peaceful and respectful of that we all enjoy equality and that we live in relationships with our planet that are sustainable. So for me, dignity is what Avishai Margalit calls decency. And it means sustainability, both socially and ecologically.
Thank you. Thank you. I use the word dignity a lot because I feel that I, at some point in my life, was insane, and I could describe that by saying I had no sense of dignity. And yeah, and so I share that a lot with people. And so in time, my innate dignity has become, shines in me. But sometimes when I use the word dignity, people are confused. They're not quite sure about what that means. So I would like to ask you, could you describe the difference between dignity and honor?
This differentiation has a large place in my work. Many people take honor and dignity to be equivalent. They speak about honor and dignity in the same way. And in some ways, this is also defendable. One could do that. In my work, I have decided to separate these two words and to use them in different ways. I have decided in my work to use the word honor on societies or on social arrangements where the worthiness of a person is ranked. Like if you wanted a very stark example, it was the apartheid system. There were higher beings, you know, people who were born as better people, the white people, and then people who were lesser beings. And in such a ranked society, I would use the word honor for the worthiness of a person. The worthiness of a person in such a situation, such a context, is ranked. Some more, some less. And then I use the word dignity for contexts where the worthiness of people is regarded to be equal. Equality in dignity. This is the first sentence of the first article of the Universal Human Rights Declaration. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. It doesn't read all human beings are born free and equal in honor and rights. No, in dignity and rights. So dignity, yet equality in dignity. It's a different concept compared to honor. Honor, I find, is fitting in to use in societies that are ranked and that are also collectivistic. Dignity is a term that fits better into societies of equality and dignity that also have an emphasis on the person, on the individual person. And in you might remember in 1757, the word to humiliate changed in its meaning. And I think this has to do also with the definition of honor and dignity. In 1757, for the first time, we see in the Oxford Encyclopedia in the English language that to humiliate means to violate somebody's dignity. So before 1757, to humiliate and to humble were rather similar. And it was regarded as pro-social that a higher being, a master, an aristocrat would humiliate or humble an inferior, like would beat his wife. The wife would then have to accept to swallow being beaten and respect being beaten and to humiliate and to humble. You know, humiliation would be used to create humility, to show lowly people their due place. So in 1757, in the English language, there was a U-turn, a normative ethical U-turn expressed in linguistics. It's a kind of historical marker. And I think this is a very interesting marker that differentiates also shame and humiliation. So there are interesting historical developments of our culture, in this case, English language, but I other realms, in other cultural realms on our planet.
So there might be instances where I feel humiliated because of the story I tell myself. Someone else might not feel humiliated by a particular circumstance. So I wonder if you could elaborate on that in terms of culture, religion, etc.
I lived in Egypt, as I said, and I know the Egyptian desert quite well. And I remember that there were the oases in the Libyan desert when they still had no electricity. No, there was a time they had no road. There was no road. They would bring the dates to the next city by camel. And I even, you know, was on this trail, on this track to see it, even after the road had been built. So these oases, the population of these oases, they had at some point no connection to the outside world. And then when the road was built, they had cars coming suddenly, and they had tourists coming. And at some point, they even had television. And, you know, when they had no connection, they were poor, but they didn't know that they were poor. You could say it was absolute inequality. You know, they were poor, but they didn't know. And then when the tourists came and the television came, they saw suddenly people who had so much more than they had, in all respects, more food, more things. They saw Dallas, the soap opera television. Imagine, in the middle of the desert where they had very little. And suddenly, you know, this kind of exposure to the larger world was like a lesson in relative deprivation. You could say, you know, they saw that others had so much more and they had so much less, okay? And then in the first moment, they accepted it. You know, religion says that some people, you know, as long as you believe that God wants some people to be born high and some people to be born low, then, you know, that you have nothing is like a natural disaster and you accept it. It might be hurtful, but you accept it. Okay, when comes the turn to humiliation? When you no longer accept it. When human rights defendants or advocates come to you and say, wait a minute, it's not God's will, it's not divinely ordained, it's not natural law that you have nothing. No, it's a violation of your human rights. And who does this? Who perpetrates this violation on you? Those who have so much. They plunder the world for its resources, and you are the victims of this. So it's not a kind of natural disaster that must be accepted. No, 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 no. Do, and, you know, Paulo Freire has coined this word conscientization, you know, which means feel humiliated and do something, you know. You have a right to feel humiliated for being down, for having nothing, for being at the bottom. You have a right to feel humiliated. Exercise this right, manifest it in your emotions, feel humiliated and rise up. Okay. So human rights, yes?
What that sparks in me is the question of violence. So someone rightly feels humiliated, and the humiliation comes from a differential of power. And so many times what rises up is feelings of violence. Going back to Rwanda, for instance, where you lived, Somalia, etc. So if you would talk to us about the time you spent in Africa and how that relates to how we use violence.
Yes, this is a very interesting point. I think that human rights defenders are usually oblivious of, or they choose not to think about it, that they carry a huge, huge responsibility to do more than simply make people angry. Who for? Many people who listen to you now and to us now might not relate to examples from Africa. Let me therefore also include a domestic example that might be more easily to relate to. Like, imagine your neighbor beats his wife, and you go and you inform the authorities, and a social worker goes to them and says to the wife, look, you are being humiliated systematically by your husband. Don't you want to do something? You should, you know, especially for your children, you should somehow do something to preserve or repair your dignity and also for your children. And, you know, and then the wife might say, one possibility, the wife might say, oh, no, I bring it upon myself. I'm not an obedient wife. Therefore, he has a right to. This would be the position of the person who accepts loneliness and accepts humiliation, like a natural disaster, or even, you know, having brought it upon herself. The other thing could be that she slowly listens to the social worker and says, yes, you were right. You know, I have a right to become very angry, you know, and what could I do? And, you know, okay, let us now imagine she goes and she kills her husband. This would be then your question. You know, about violence. And now let's go to Africa and let's go to your back to your question, because exactly that happened in Rwanda. You know, people who were at the bottom and who for many centuries accepted it, these were the Hutus. Hutu means servant in Kenya, Rwanda. So the servants for centuries kind of accepting their patron-client position or the patron-client structure of Rwandan society. For them, it was like, you know, the sun goes up and down and we have Tutsi patrons. It was like a natural law. And then comes 1959. It was Belgians who somehow, you know, I read the book by Guy Logiste, in Rwanda, he describes the joy, the profound joy with which the Hutu revolution emerged. And the people, the Hutus, who were at the bottom or were servants for so long, rose up and reclaimed or claimed a dignity that they didn't have before. And the joy connected to that. So they rose up and they were brought by the Belgians into positions of power, and the former Tutsi elite was kind of toppled, and half of them left into exile in Africa and half of them became a humiliated minority. And in 1994, the former elite became the victims of the genocide. So here you have people who were at the bottom, the Hutus, they rose up, and at some point they killed their former, they attempted to kill all of their former oppressors or their former aristocracy, the former elite. So there you see that your question has a very, very profound relevance, and I see it everywhere. It's not enough to simply become angry. And to, you know, because at that point you are in danger to continue the cycle of humiliation. The human rights movement needs one step more, not only replacing the tyrant and, you know, continuing with the tyranny, but it requires to restructure profoundly a society from ranked, you know, seeing people to be ranked in worthiness, to a society where everybody is regarded as equal in worthiness, as equal in dignity. This is the profound restructuring that is needed. And if we look at, if we want to manifest human rights ideals, then this is the restructuring we must do. And Nelson Mandela is the person who really demonstrates that. Imagine what he could have done when he came out of prison. Could have done the same that happened in Rwanda. In Rwanda, it needed only a radio station to talk to the Hutu population and tell them to take their knives, their machetes, and kill their Tutsi neighbors. Nelson Mandela would have had the power to tell his black sisters and brothers, take your knives, go to the white neighborhoods and kill them all. I think he would have had the power, but he did not do that. This is the lesson for human rights defenders.
So if, in fact, the people who are the oppressors, at least some of them are psychopaths, what can we do about that? Somebody asked me that question the other day. A young person who was 21 years old said to me, okay, so we all get together, but what do we do with the people who are drunk on power? And I had a very hard time answering that in another way than a violent way. What have you found out about what we can do together to change the cycle?
Yes, I think it's must be a kind of bottom-up, top-down change that we have to envision. And I'm thinking a lot about this. Violence is not a good way, not just for the victims. It's the perpetrators lose their dignity also. So if you want to create a world of dignity and you do it by violence, you can't. It's undermining its own aim. So it's not a viable path. So we need to think of other ways. And there is this bottom-up, top-down approach that we have to think of, I think. I often meet people who are still in kind of the past. I think... Paul Ray, you might know Paul Ray and Sherry Ruth Anderson. They wrote the book The Cultural Creatives.
Yes, yes.
Yes, and they describe the recent history in the following way. They say if you read Wall Street the mainstream media, then they call this voice the voice of the moderns. And then they say there are traditionals who are a kind of counter-movement. Traditionals would be like politically right-wing Christians in the United States. Then they said, okay, then there were two other counter-movements who started, and they started in the 1968 time. One movement that wanted to go and demonstrate in the streets and the other movement that wanted to go and meditate. So one movement turning inwards and one movement turning outwards. And in their book that came out, The Cultural Creatives, in 2000, they said now is the time, historical time, where these two movements come together. And I think this we have to conceptualize on many levels, this coming together of the the bottom-up movement or approach, which means to go and the consciousness of people. This was the part of the first counter movement that wanted to meditate and to reach a new level of consciousness. This is one approach, but the other approach to demonstrate in the streets is not wrong either. Both have their place, and we need to combine them better now and not to kind of be hostile to each other as it was in the beginning when people who meditated would look down on those who demonstrated and vice versa. So today I think we have to connect these two approaches. One thing is that we have to really, really try to reach many people, and this is what you do with your work, and I do also with my work. We have to reach many, many people so that more and more people would not elect people who are drunk on power into influential positions. So create conditions for them to get drunk on power. This is the responsibility of the broad, of the human family as a whole. And the top-down approach is important also. Equivalent to going out in the streets, the top-down approach would mean to change the institutions of our world, how our world is organized. And there, social psychology experiments with the prisoner's dilemma game are very interesting. This is a game that you can, if played, it somehow highlights cooperation versus cheating on each other. Mm-hmm. It's a game that you can give students to play and look, you know, what will they do? Will they cooperate or will they cheat on each other? So one experiment in social psychology shows that if you give this game to play to a certain group of students and you tell them this is a Wall Street game, then they will cheat on each other. And then you give the same game to the same students or, you know, similar, very equivalent, no differences in personality or status, anything. And you tell them this is a game, a community game. They will cooperate. So there you see what is called the power of framing. So it's not enough to have a new consciousness. It's also important how we frame the situation. If we frame our world as a Wall Street game, and this is what we do now, then we shouldn't be astonished that people play it. They will cheat and they will get drunk on power because this is being glorified by our frames today. Okay, so if we want to change that, we need to check. So here we see that just simply or only thinking of changing the consciousness of people is not enough. We need also to change the frames. This would be equivalent to going into the streets and demonstrate. We need to, you know, to do more than demonstrate. Demonstrating is still kind of adolescent thing, you know, that you go and you ask your parents, you know, become different parents, better parents, you know, why are you so bad parents? So we need to become the parents who, you know, people who want to change this world. We have to stop being adolescents and we have to take the steering wheel of this world and change the frames.
So, would you like to comment on the Occupy movement?
Yes, I wrote my last book. The title is A Dignity Economy. And I wrote it because of the Occupy movement somehow asked me and encouraged me. I was both in Portland, Oregon, and in New York, and so as a result, I wrote this book. I had prepared for it since many years, and somehow I didn't plan to finish it at that point, and I did. It came out in February now. So, you know, all these lessons that we have now discussed are precisely the lessons any movement who wants to create a better world, more dignified world, a more decent world, they have to heed, like, no violence, not least, you know, as soon as you also the perpetrator undermines his and her own dignity, then the next step would be get out of adolescence. Do not demonstrate against anything. Create a new alternative and think about new frames, especially those people. You know, I think at the moment we have many people, when I go around the world, I see many grassroots movements, many people who try to change their local context with some projects, some kind of very valuable projects. What I see is missing is people who think globally and who think about our global frames. And our, you know, just the simple question, how is money coming into existence? I don't know anybody really who can explain that. Very, very difficult, very, very important. This is perhaps the most important frame we live in now, and nobody knows about it. It's very, very stealth. It's a stealth frame. And we have to change it. And how can we change it if we don't even think about it? And if we are not even informed? So, you know, what are the rules of the IMF, the World Bank? What is behind there? I just spent the first 5 weeks of my time in South America, in Chile, with the philosopher of social science, Howard Richards, who has just written a new book, Rethinking Thinking, where he would be, by the way, somebody you should interview, Howard Richards in Chile. And he would say that we have to go back 2,000 years, more than 2,000 years. We have to go back to the beginnings of Roman law. And there we have to take another turn. So it's not enough to simply want to change the world. Our work of thinking and understanding and global understanding. Understanding of global frames. And at that point, I see there are too few people who do that.
So, for instance, in Brazil some years ago, economists managed to change the way the population thought about money. And therefore, the currency became stronger. They changed the name of the currency and it became stronger. So how would it be possible for us to change our thinking about money? Do we have to understand how money came about and how money is happening in the world? How can we change our basic thinking about sharing, which, of course, is based on money right now?
May I recommend another person to interview? His name is Paul Grignon. He is living on Gabriola Island, not far from Vancouver, you know, just opposite of Vancouver, Canada. And he has created three films called Money as Debt. And he has also tried to think through what could be done, how could this be changed. And he has developed the idea of digital coin, which is all based on the thought that money should not be a commodity in limited supply. Money should be something like centimeters, you know, to facilitate exchange. You don't want to exchange a cow for a television or so. You don't want the basic exchange. How, you know, the money came about to facilitate exchange. And we don't want to lose that function of money. So it should be something you measure value, like you measure with centimeters or meters, you measure something. So you could use money to measure value so that you can exchange easier. This we want to maintain this function of money. However, money has also acquired a second function or more other functions, which is, among others, that it became a commodity on its own account. This is something we cannot continue with. It is not a good institution. We have to change that. It is as if we as a human family are in the middle of an experiment that will lead to an unsustainable future for us. So we have to stop this, to rethink this experiment and change it so that we can have a sustainable future on this planet.
Thank you. Let's talk about something that we both love, prioritizing love.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, yes. Love, you know, I was just recently discussing with people that some words have been emptied of their meaning so much that we almost want to leave them behind. Love has become a label for commercialization, Valentine's Day, and now that love is only expressed in accumulation of possessions and so. So sometimes I think you and me, we are so frustrated and sad about this development that we almost don't want to use the word love anymore, and it is a bit too empty sometimes. But so I decided, I wrote my third book on love. It has a different title, Gender, Humiliation and Global Security, but basically it's a book about love where I say, okay, let's rescue the concept of love, let's rescue it. And let's give it a much more substantial meaning than simply buying diamond rings. There are several concepts that lend themselves to giving more substance to love. There is satyagraha that Gandhi used, truth, firm love, you know, the connection between truth and firmness and love. So an important connection. Then the other is that love is not something that befalls us or that we fall into. Love is something we have to nurture. If we don't nurture it, it will not be there. Like it's with a, like with a garden. If you don't plan how you want to plant the plants, if you don't plant them, if you don't give them water, there will be no garden. This is the same with love. There will be no love if you don't nurture it. And many people think that it should simply fall from the sky or kind of, yeah. So there's, of course, there are also linguistic connections there, luck and so. But this is another thing. When I said before that when I look around, and as you know, I live now globally since almost 40 years, and I have now finger on the pulse of all cultures, more or less. I don't know anybody who has lived like that, you know, without a base, really. You know, I don't travel. I really live in different cultural contexts around the world. And what I see first is missing that, what I said before, people who are thinking globally and who think about the global frames, global institutions we are all kind of framed by. This is the first lack I see. And the next one is that people seem to not understand that love and social cohesion in society must be nurtured proactively, that we have to do something for it to be there. At the moment, I must say that I see this social cohesion, or whatever one calls it, the glue in society, that what as a human family, this is being weakened all over the world in the context of one might call predator capitalism. I was spending time in the Amazon in Marabá, Pará, in Brazil, just now in June, 2 weeks. This is a community that is somehow standing in the way of so-called progress. Mining, building of a big dam, logging, this is all what is happening, the industrialization of the Amazon. And this community somehow is in the way there. And, you know, the river, I was living there in this community, very poor community, just 10 meters away from the river that is the dying river. And mercury coming in, the children getting blind from the toxins in the water, and so. So all this is somehow accepted or officially condoned. They pay for so-called progress. So this community standing in its way is being kind of targeted, like many other people who are standing in the way of logging, mining, are being killed by hired gunmen everywhere there. And this guy observed that it's not just a hired gunman, but it's also a kind of systematic weakening of the social fabric of communities that is happening, and not just in this community. In this community, this was just more starkly visible, you know, or in other parts of the world, so-called developed world, it's also being done, but more covert. So I see that all around the world at the moment, what you and me would like to see, namely more love in societies, more love, more a stronger social web and social glue and everywhere is being weakened via public policy, wherever I see and I go.
So, Evelyn, we have a few minutes left, and I'd like to ask you, talk to us about solution, about the university that you and other people have founded and the thousands of people who have joined.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you so much. Yes, last year, World Dignity University Initiative, and we plan to develop it like a movement, not like the traditional organization. And I often use the example of the Arab Spring. Imagine the people in Egypt who wanted to, who called upon the Egyptian population to come to Cairo, to come to the Tahrir Square. These kind of instigators of the Arab Spring Revolution, they did not sit down, make a business plan, hired some fundraisers and then got some funds and then hired some revolutionaries and then performed a revolution as a kind of project. And when the funding would dry out, the revolution would be finished. This is the normal path of projects I see all about around the world. Sitting down, founding an organization, employing some people, when the funding is finished, when the project becomes a little bit too successful, then the funding will be cut and then it will be finished. So we don't want to go down that path. Therefore, we have a zero budget. We don't have a pre-defined organization. We want to go back to the original meaning of the word university, universitas. It means a fellowship of scholars. It doesn't mean an institution. It means that people stand up, educators, scholars, thinkers, stand up and say, we want to become professors at the World Dignity University, and we want to come to bring whatever we can bring to the table. Like the people, you know, in Egypt, they took a vacation, they paid their train ticket, they came to Cairo. So like that, we want to call upon everybody like-minded in the world who would like to bring more dignity into the world to come and to... And we have another metaphor to explain how to contribute. We describe our initiative like a tree, like the core team. We are about four people in the center of this initiative, and we give water and we nurture the trunk and the roots of this tree of our initiative, and we invite everybody to come and to contribute and to build their own branches on this tree. And that way we manifest what I think is the core of dignity, namely unity in diversity. We want to be unified in that we are emphasizing equality in dignity. This unifies us. And then we want to cherish and celebrate diversity. So therefore, also our professors must be very, very, very diverse professors. And they must come and bring their knowledge and wisdom to the table. So we need to start by doing a small video of 10 minutes where they explain who they are, what they think about dignity, and how they could envision to contribute to such a global World Dignity University initiative. So this is our path, a movement, not a fixed. We want to be in the future, in the paradigm of dignity of the future, not in the paradigm of the past.
So I want to remind our listeners that the sound may be a little iffy, but we are talking with Evelyn Lindner, who is in a mountain retreat in Norway. So, Evelyn, we're coming to the end of this particular conversation. What would you like to say in closing? And let me express my gratitude to you for your work and your words.
Oh, dear Joanna, let me express my gratitude to you. It's wonderful. You are from my point of view, I would give you a PhD in dignity, and you are a professor at the World Dignity University with all the work you are doing. So let me really convey my profound gratitude and admiration to you. Thank you so much for your work, Joanna.
And a few words to our listeners, perhaps about how to be more aware of one's own dignity.
Perhaps once be that when people ask me who I am and what I do for to earn my living, I say, I don't want a job. I want a life. So I think changing our language, stepping out of the old paradigm of how life should be, stepping out of it and looking at this world, looking at this planet and thinking much, much, much deeper and thinking, what do we want? What do we do as human beings born onto this on this planet? What should we do so that our children will find a decent life on this planet? So this, I think, should be the first thought. And then comes the second thought. And at the moment, I see so many people struggling, you know, within the old paradigm, which is dysfunctional. And so the step to make is to step out of this old dysfunctional paradigm.
Okay, well, rest well in the beauty that surrounds you and the beauty that you are.
And thank you for the beauty that you manifest and represent, dear Joanna. And please greet also your husband very much from me.
I will. Goodbye.
Goodbye.